On This Week in Enterprise Tech, everyone's getting hacked, and we get your big data with some Splunk. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twiet.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 75, recorded January 13th, 2014. Splunk goes your big data. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasier, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I'm not guiding you by myself. I'm joined by a fantastic cast of characters, starting with my good friend, Mr. Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, how is the geek in paradise?
Oh, the geek in paradise is having a lot of fun because tomorrow I get to meet with a whole bunch of researchers and we're going to put together a grant to possibly get some new undersea cables heading both east and west. Ought to be awesome.
Now, I remember you were working on an undersea cable project when I was there. This is different. This is not just taking someone else's cables. This is laying brand new fiber.
Not only laying brand new fiber, but also new, brand spanking new cable landing station on the other side of the island so that we can have multiple entrance points just in case some idiot drags his anchor.
Dragging his anchor, that could be the show title. Now, let me tell you who isn't dragging his anchor. He's back after a long hiatus. He is our version of Jiminy Cricket, Mr. Oliver Rist. Oliver, great to have you back. We missed you. How have you been?
Well, let's see.
Oh,
not that great.
What did you do?
Well, it turns out riding a motorcycle where there might be black ice, it's not the best idea. So, yeah, broken ribs and a broken finger later. I'm housebound.
Wait. How are you even talking to us? Broken ribs are crazy painful.
Well, it was 3 weeks ago, so now they're only agonizing as opposed to debilitating.
Well, I'm sure this will only add to the edge that we love so much. Let's take that edge and go straight into the Enterprise Byte. This first one is gonna, well, sound familiar, even though it's really a new player. We have information that Neiman Marcus has finally confirmed that, yes, they did have a data breach. Now, you may remember just a few weeks ago, we heard all about the Target breach. That's right, the Thanksgiving snafu, where for more than 2 weeks, Target cards through their retail store were compromised. People were getting their information stolen, their private data, and even, yes, their credit card numbers themselves. Now, Neiman Marcus has come clean, and they're really confusing. They said, yes, they know they've been breached. They know that customer information has been compromised, but they're not really sure how much. They don't know when the breach started. They don't know how long it's run. They don't even know if it's done. They're not sure. They haven't been able to go through their system and confirm that they found all the different places that have been leaking information out into the wild. Now, they first started looking at a possible breach back in mid-December, which is getting people really, really worried because this seems to be the old way of dealing with a breach, which is a large company wanting to do some damage control doesn't tell people that their information may have been compromised until it's already too late. The financial industry was awash with reports of an increase, a strange increase in fraudulent charges, not from their online stores, but from their retail stores, Neiman Marcus brick and mortar. It's also accompanied by a indication that none of the online customers have been affected at all. Now, Chibert, I want to throw this over to you because we're seeing this more and more and more where people had been worried about cybersecurity. They had been worried about sharing their financial information online. We're now seeing the big breaches, the major breaches, not taking place online, but with brick and mortar companies. Why is this happening?
You know, I don't know. There shouldn't have been any changes. The PCI regulations haven't changed. The security techniques really haven't changed. All I can think of is that some CFO or some bean counter decided to get really, really cheap and started mixing general purpose traffic in with the credit card validation. Lots of stores used to physically air gap credit card and register data from general purpose data just because. Now, there's been a lot of pushes at different financial institutions to combine it, say, oh, VLANs are just good enough. That's all fine, good. And no, it's not. So all I can think of is that we're starting to see the results of CFOs having way too much control over the network without knowing the consequences.
Oliver, let me throw this over to you. I think you could give us an interesting perspective on this. When we were building financial transaction systems a couple of decades ago, there was always that mindset of, look, air gap it. Make sure that no exterior system can contact it. Make sure that you control exactly where that data is going to go. What is it that has allowed us to start thinking, well, no, it's okay for us to network our financial transaction systems. It's okay for us to put the servers that actually hold confidential user information online. Why are these systems anywhere near the internet?
Convenience. I mean, you know, people always want to do something that's easier, regardless of whether it's safe or not. Safe comes way at the end, right? I mean, you see people out there doing banking on their iPads in a coffee shop. Why? Because it's easier. Do they care that iOS has probably never really been tested against anything from the outside? No, they're just going to do it until something blows up. So I'm sure that these companies have huge compliance regs that they have to adhere to, but there's going to be some guy who looks a lot like Brian who is an admin in the back, and he's doing something for his own convenience sake that somebody else on the outside found, and now they're going to go steal stuff in meat space rather than cyberspace because it's probably safer.
All right, which is strange. I think we're seeing this trend where the hackers out there, the ones who really want to penetrate a network, are realizing that online systems, for the most part, have been hardened. Even if you can breach them, it's difficult to get the matching sets of information that allow you to actually do something with the private information that's been taken. Retail stores, not so much. Now, Chibert, I want to go back to something that you mentioned. You mentioned the PCI, which is the PCI DSS, which stands for the, the Payment Card Industry Data Security Standard, which is just a set of parameters that determine whether or not you meet the credit card standards for security. Now, Jason's going to bring up a little bit of a graphic here that talks a little bit about what makes up the PCI DSS. It's based on four different control objectives. The first, which is to build and maintain a secure network. The second, which is to protect cardholder data. The third, which is to maintain a vulnerability management program. And the fourth, which is to implement strong access control measures. Now, these control objectives are supposed to be matched up with PCI DSS requirements. And supposedly, if you follow these measures, these guidelines, your system should be secure. Now, Chibert, I want to throw this over to you because I think you may have some experience with this. There's a lot of talk in the industry right now that the PCI DSS standards are a scam, that even if you meet them 100%, it doesn't mean your network is secure. Others are complaining that those standards were really only created vaguely so that the credit card companies can fine you anytime you don't measure up to the PCI DSS. In fact, that's a big source of income for these financial institutions. What is it about PCI DSS that's inherently insecure or unstable?
Well, PCI DSS, if you read the real text, you know, not just someone's summary, it was written by bean counters. There isn't any mention at all about any kind of technology. Not even in, you know, very broad strokes. Realistically, if you just shut down a whole bunch of ports and rely on an external PCI audit, you know, tool where you just scans your network, even a El Cheapo router can meet PCI regs. Now, the realistic view of the world is the regulations are so weak that you can have, you know, even guest wireless on your PCI compliant network as long as it's got a strong password on it. But that strong password could be pasted up on the wall in the lunchroom.
So
and
wait,
still
wait.
PCI compliant.
Let me get this straight. I could have a supposedly PCI DSS compliant network and just have that random access point that allows me to access the network as long as I put what they might consider a strong password.
That is correct.
That's
nuts. Realistically, it's kind of like when Starbucks first came out. You know, is very, very vague. Starbucks does not mandate any kind of technology, nor should it. But PCI does have some, you know, technology components in it, and it needs to be closed down. There needs to be something more reasonable about it. Personally, I think the PCI folks need to start taking a few pages from the classified data networks as spelled out by the NISPOM Chapter 8.
All right. Oliver, I want to go over to you. We had a very good comment in the chat room from T-Man, who was essentially saying meeting the PCI DSS recs only means that if you do get breached, the financial companies will cover the cost of your breach. They'll be financially responsible for it. That sounds like a completely backward way to do it, right? Because essentially all the companies are enticed to do is to cover their asses. As long as I do these things, even if I know my network is not really secure, it's fine because I don't have to worry about the financial losses. What is the solution for this? I mean, do you change the regulations? Do you say, look, you have to pen test your networks. You actually have to contract with these security companies who will come in and tell you what's messed up, what you can and cannot do. Or are we ever stuck in this loop of, as long as I'm not financially responsible, I really don't care what happens to my customers' data?
Yeah, I'm not really sure where you think this is backwards. This is the American way, dude.
Okay.
Right? It's always CYA. I mean, I had a consulting contract, or we bid on a consulting contract a few years before I came out here to a taxi cab company in Manhattan. We felt sure we had it because we did some quote-unquote pen testing of their wireless network, where they were basically transmitting credit card numbers and usernames or names in clear text through New York. And we figured, hey, we pointed out to them, and obviously they're definitely gonna hire us, right? I mean, there's no way that they could say no. So, of course, they did say no. A bunch of bearded guys who were counting money, and they said, well, nothing's ever happened, and besides which, credit cards are insured, so we don't care. So as long as people don't get hurt, of course they're not going to do it.
I really like that. That's Cheebert. Let me throw that back over to you, because you said, look, the reason why this is happening is because PCI DSS was made by a bunch of bean counters. Oliver counters with, look, that's how it's going to be. The bean counters are the one who are controlling the purse strings. They're the ones who are making the contracts. You may come up with a better engineered solution, but unless you've got the execs backing your play, no one's going to implement it. I mean, that's kind of the way of the world, right?
Oh, yeah. Just look at Europe versus America, or actually anywhere else in the world versus America. Chip and PIN is actually a pretty good system. You know, it's something you have and something you know. So it's a multi-factor authentication. But it's not in the U.S. American Express tried Chip and PIN, but nobody wanted to do it. They didn't see a financial reason to adopt a more secure multi-factor authentication for credit card transactions, because our system's better. It works. I don't have to spend all that extra money. And it really does come down to money. Until we get that prediction, remember we made those predictions about this massive data spill and so forth? That's what's going to be needed before the credit card companies finally, you know, get their head out of the sand and do something like chip and PIN. You know, the technology's there. They're just not willing to adopt it.
That is kind of weird that we just had that prediction show, and just a few days later, the thing that we thought would happen within 6 months seems to already happen. I mean, between Target and Neiman Marcus, and it really sounds as if the security researchers are saying, this is not the end. This was a pattern. We've got a group of people, of penetration network hackers, who were using a common vulnerability across a lot of brick-and-mortar stores. We're probably going to see more than Neiman Marcus and Target come up in the next couple of months and say, yeah, we lost like a lot of customer data. But in just a couple of days after that prediction show, it's already happened. We've already seen a wholesale loss of customer information. Now, Oliver, let me throw the last word over to you, because, again, you're our Jiminy Cricket. It is all about the money. We know that. And it is all about liability. It is all about cover your ass. But Do you see a scenario in which something like chip and PIN, with something like more robust encryption, something like air-gapped networks, would become the more economical thing to do rather than to constantly admit to these breaches in your network security?
Is needless markup going to spend money on a security system? No, not unless they get hurt. I mean, I just said it, right? If they get hurt, whether by lawsuit, whether by legislation, whatever, yes. Without that, no. I don't see any reason why they would.
Wow. Guys, I got to say, you know, this has been a really negative story. I could use an enterprise bite to cheer us up, so let's move on to the next one. And that is, that's right, small satellite dishes are ripe for hacking. This should cheer us right up. We've got a report that are talking about VSATs. That's very small aperture terminals. You've probably seen them in the movies. You know, anytime you've got someone who has something that looks like a notebook and it flips up and they get a connection to a satellite. Well, that's a VSAT. The way that they work is you have an antenna that is pointed right over the horizon, at a satellite right over the horizon. Worldwide, there are more than 2.9 million VSATs in use. About two-thirds of them are in use in the United States. They're used on very remote locations, either remote branches or, say, oil rigs or exploratory rigs or teams that are just out in the boonies. Now, VSATs work by sending data to a satellite on the horizon, and they can be as small as a laptop or as big as one of those big dishes that you see on the top of, say, gas stations. A company called IntelCrawler found that many of these terminals had default passwords that were accessible over the internet. In other words, they were able to narrow their scanning range to an IP range they thought a lot of these VSATs would sit in, and then they started hammering them with the default usernames and passwords, and they found that over half of them responded by giving them root access. Obviously, not a good thing. Chibert, I want to throw this over to you. This sounds horrible, especially when you consider what those remote terminals are connected to. If they are connected to those exploratory wells, if they are connected to those SCADA systems out in the boonies, this is actually a huge vulnerability, is it not?
Well, it's even worse than that. If you look on the top of just about any Chevron station anywhere in the United States especially, you're going to see a VSAT antenna. Now, most people don't, you know, they think, okay, this is not a big deal because it's VSAT. The equipment's relatively expensive. It's hard to spoof it, and you have to be in line with the antenna. So not so bad. However, keep in mind, these connections are expensive enough that Norm Abramson, Dr. AlohaNet, and I were working on a startup to do basically proxy caching for VSAT antennas. And in those days, still valid today, even a 1% or 2% speed gain was big, big, big money. So we actually did okay, but unfortunately, the startup didn't start up. Anyway, VSATs are vulnerable because they're cheap, they're easy. In a lot of cases, especially in places that are insanely expensive, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Manhattan, VSATs are small enough you can actually aim them between buildings and get satellite access. And when you do a giant contract like what Chevron has done, they just start using that instead of landlines. So, yeah, VSATs before, they're kind of like, you know, your cable modem. They're not that much different, except they're using RF. It's just too easy to drop and go. In fact, a lot of the VSAT systems replacements get shipped to the gas station, and the gas station owner has to go and truck it up and put it up on top of the roof. That's how commoditized VSATs have become.
Right. It's just a dumb terminal that you plug in and it goes. Now, an interesting part of this story is that the login pages for a lot of these VSATs were crawled and therefore were made available on certain search engines like Google and Bing. It reminds me of a vulnerability in some Axis network cameras a while back where these crawlers would find the login page, and it would also include the version, the version of the firmware. And people who knew a version of firmware that would be vulnerable were just looking. They were using a Boolean search to find just the cameras that you could get into. I want to throw this over to you, Oliver, because this is an interesting story. It involves technologies that tends to be forgotten. These little VSATs that were plugged in, they were left with either default username and password or no username and password because they were supposed to be used by non-technical people because the corporations didn't want you always calling their IT department to reset the password. with these forgotten terminals, which really can't be upgraded easily. I mean, it's all hard-coded in. You have to replace the terminals in order to get rid of the vulnerabilities. They don't. The big takeaway from the story is they don't see this vulnerability going away anytime soon. They're not going to spend thousands of dollars to upgrade these remote terminals. And so this is a vulnerability we're just going to have to live with. Do you think that this is a situation we're going to find more and more and more as we get more of these devices that are persistently online? That the older ones, we just accept that they're going to get owned at any time?
Yes. I'm going to go with yes on that one, and probably for the same reason as in our previous discussion. It's too expensive to get rid of them.
Yeah. So it just comes back down to money.
Hey, it's America, baby.
Oh, wow. Okay. Let's do one more Enterprise Bite. And again, I want something cheery, so let's go with this. That's right. SCADA gets owned again. We've heard about this before. You know those little devices that allow you to gather command and control data off of things like pipelines and energy conduits? Well, hackers in Russia have managed to gain full control of critical SCADA systems. Why is this important? Because we've heard stories like this before. Well, this is slightly different in that previous stories about SCADA hacks have been about taking over particular units or parts of the functionality of a SCADA unit. In this case, they were able to use a combination of zero-day vulnerabilities to take complete control. They were able to log in as root. They were able to do anything to that SCADA device that you could do while standing in front of it. Chibert, let me throw this over to you. Could you please give us a picture of exactly what SCADA devices do in our world?
Well, they control valves in refineries. They control things like the rudders on ships. they control nuclear reactors. So, and the problem is SCADA was originally designed as a multi-drop serial network. So a lot of the original old SCADA devices, hell, if you ping them more than three times in a row, they'll tip over and reboot. It's basically a lot of industrial equipment that was retasked onto the network that really shouldn't have been. And most of the time, they're being set up by chemical engineers or mechanical engineers or structural engineers, and they don't always understand it. My number one gripe in the world is the engineering college at most universities don't teach networking. So you get engineers putting in really, really weak security, really weak devices. And, you know, if you're on a ship network, if you're on the control network, it is not that hard to take over the steering of a major ship. That's how scary the SCADA vulnerabilities are.
Wow. Oliver, let me throw back to you. The study found that over 60,000 compromised systems were available to be attacked. That's actually a staggering amount. It doesn't specifically say which systems, where they're located, or what they're controlling. But I think the point that they were trying to get across is, again, like the last story, these are persistent pieces of technology that have a persistent advanced attack threat built into them. There is no easy way to update all of these SCADA devices without replacing them. And we don't really have anything to replace them. One of the things about SCADA is because it's been around so long, it's universal. And every engineer, as Chibert mentioned, knows how to use them. They know how to program for them. Switching to something that would be more secure would be a major undertaking. It wouldn't be as simple as swapping out a part. You'd actually have to retrain your entire population of civil engineers. My question to you is this. This is something that I think Enterprise is going to see more and more often, which is, again, these outdated devices that have vulnerabilities, and then you have to weigh the risk assessment of, well, how much damage can it really do? Do we really have to update? Do we really have to retrain? Versus maybe it's just not a good idea to have compromised devices on our network. Where do you think the tipping point's going to be?
I can't answer you right now because I'm booking my escape flight to Costa Rica. I can't deal with this.
Okay.
Are you telling me those things are here in the U.S. or just in Russia?
Oh, no, in the United States. Absolutely in the United States.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, of course. That's fantastic. Well, I'm assuming since Brian said nuclear reactors and he used to work in the government, you are going to tell me that at least those have been audited by somebody given all the terrorist activity and all the Chinese cyber warfare stuff.
Chibert?
Please tell me, right? Something.
Chibert, can you?
Anything.
Can you chime in here, Chibert?
Air gap.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
Thank God.
Okay, good. So that's a start. Okay, so they're not actually hooked up to anything. So here's another question, Chibert. Why is there not an air gap on everything else?
Well, that's the trick. That's the reason why there hasn't been refineries and nuclear reactors melting down left and right. They aren't connected. And if you can connect to it, you have to go in through a proxy. So you'll typically have to log into a strongly secured machine before you can go further in. None of the really, really, really sensitive SCADA systems are even connected to anything other than themselves, which is one of the reasons why sometimes it's hard to go and bring the electric grid back online. It's not all doom and gloom. There's a lot of corporations, like, for instance, Lantronix is actually doing a really good job of introducing a whole new line of SCADA devices that are nearly plug compatible, but are strong enough security-wise that you could actually put them right onto the internet and expect them to be able to ward off attacks. So it's getting better. It's just that it's follow the money. You know, a lot of people don't want to replace the old stuff because they don't want to spend money.
Got it. All right. Well, there you have it. Three discussions about how money is going to lead to the takeover by the machines. Now, when we get back, we're going to be talking all about big data, but this time we're getting our hands dirty. We're going to show you what you personally could do with big data and tools that you can download from the internet right now. But before we do that, let's take a moment to talk about the first sponsor of the Twiat Riot. You know them, you love them, it's Ring Central. And when Leo built the brick house, he decided that we were going to do everything we possibly could in the cloud. We wanted to store our documents, hold our meetings, and we didn't want a big old PBX system sitting in the basement. So when Russell, our legendary IT guy, said that we could get a cloud-based phone system through RingCentral, well, it was really a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. Zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to easily customize all of our call handling, including allowing our producers to get their voicemail through their email. RingCentral also offers the ability to send and receive faxes straight from your PC. Now, you can get it on your smartphone, your tablet, your desktop, your notebook device. Anywhere you are, you can use RingCentral to get the communication that you need right now. New faxes will arrive in your email box so that you can always stay on top of your business. You can preview and print faxes, design cover sheets, and even sign faxes electronically right from your computer. You'll never have to use a bulky fax machine again. Now, here's what we'd like you to do. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 per month per user, so why not try it? You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Once again, just in case your information was leaked by Neiman Marcus, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get on to the big business. We've brought a friend of the show, actually a man who I've worked with for many and many years, Mr. Michael Wild, who I'm going to let you give your title. What is your title at Splunk?
You said I was a man, so that's good.
Oh, that's there yes. That. Yes, that's, we start with that.
I have this cute, yeah, see, look at that right there.
Chief of awesome. That is quite, and by the way, folks, that's not something he made up. That's actually on his business cards. Michael, let's start with this. What is Splunk? What do you guys do?
Okay, well, Splunk, we're a software company. We make software and help customers use it. We have a few products. One of them is named after the company. It's called Splunk. And the cool thing is it's downloadable. You can check it out. But for the most part of 7.5, 8 years, we've been focused on building a platform to give people, you know, real-time and historical operational intelligence of machine data, right? Machine data are all those little bits of data that are generated from the machines, who you guys were talking about are going to take over the world, from Neiman Marcus. Everything that you do, whether it's turning up your thermostat or logging into a nuclear reactor or just buying something on a website is tracked and logged somewhere. So customers use it to solve problems and, see how their business is doing and really get some really interesting information that I have some cool examples of. And it's really one of the machine data is one of the most pervasive sort of sets of big data that's out there.
Right.
So.
Now, I remember the first time that Chebert and I met you was at Interop, and you had brought Splunk to play in the Interop net. And the way that it was explained to us was, well, you know all those logs? You know those logs that you record and then you never look at again? What if we could give you a tool that will take all those logs, all those disparate pieces of information from all the different devices you've got sitting on your network, and put them together and give you some sort of relational database that you could drill through to find events and correlations? It was actually a very exciting product because Splunk was the first one that went that deep into taking all that information and giving you something understandable.
Yeah, it's still a very popular use of the product today that, you know, when you got to get deep down inside of the data or in a dark data center where things are broke, that's where the kind of name Splunk or Splunking comes from, mm-hmm. is it's an extremely good tool for that. But what we've tried to do over the past number of years is provide, you know, we're a multi-product company. So we've provided solutions for security professionals that have to deal with, attacks and vulnerabilities and PCI and all of that, and also provide user interfaces and technology for more people to do more things other than just, you know, the nerd sitting in the data center like myself, whereas, you know, perhaps a marketing person or somebody on the business side can now, especially with a recent version of our product, actually do things themselves, which is really kind of cool. So yeah. We're pretty stoked. We've in the past 7-8 years, we've gained about 6,400 customers. So there's a good chance that most of the people around here might have downloaded or used the product or might be a customer.
Right. Now let's go around the horn. I want to do this really quickly because I know anytime we talk about big data, there's going to be a little collective rolling of the eyes because we've talked about it a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have a story here from Forbes that talks about how big data in 2013 was one of these things that everyone wanted to talk about, but no one was really sure what it meant. It was kind of vaporware. We saw the promise, but no one really knew how to turn that into something that was commoditizable. Chebert, let me go to you. When you hear big data, what do you think it is? What do you associate it with?
Well, if I'm wearing my scientist hat, I'm thinking about time series data, hydrophone, seismic, so forth. If I'm wearing my IT hat, I'm thinking about the insane number of syslog entries that you have to sift through. And my favorite use for Splunk is being able to find correlations. You know, if a event happened, I have a tech support call saying 10 o'clock last night, my VoIP calls really stank. Splunk will allow me to go and index all those events and line them up so that I can go and look at the time frame and see what else happened at 10 o'clock that last night. Big data is all about being able to use it. And if you can't use it if you don't have a tool to use it, just why bother?
Why bother? Oliver, let me throw it over to you because you've got a non-system administrator view of this. You've heard about big data. You've been covering big data. What do you associate with big data the most?
Well, as of checking out Splunk's website, I'm associating the word hunk with it. Really? Seriously? Seriously, dude? Hunk? That one I heard.
It's not the cutest product name ever. Come on.
It sticks with you. Yeah.
You guys must have advertising at Thunder Down Under or something in Vegas, man.
You should mention that. If you've met the Splunk crew, they are those kind of guys. They're a little bit on the crazy side.
Ah, yeah. Okay. What do I associate with big data? Working with Microsoft, I associate it with massive amounts of marketing hype and an insane attempt or an insane expectation that this is going to deliver huge amounts of revenue, even though when we look at, you know, customers, it's all a potential. It was only a potential all last year. Even enterprise, you know, 500 customers are all talking about it. They think it's going to happen, but it isn't here yet. They're sticking with their normal data warehouses. And this giant spike in data is expected, but so far it's like a unicorn. So,
Oliver, you never fail to deliver. Thank you. Exactly. That's what I was hoping you would say. Michael, let me throw it over to you because that's what you're fighting against, especially with our crowd, with our audience, because they've heard about the promise of big data, but it's just that. It's like, yes, okay, we've heard big data is going to change the world. How exactly is it going to change the world? Question to you would be, how do you see big data? When you think of not just Splunk products, but any product that uses a big data set, how do you differentiate it from all the hype?
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to I honestly don't think the bigness of the data is really the challenge, although big is challenging because big requires scale to be able to handle it. But for some people, big data is something bigger than can fit on an Excel spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because the challenge with dealing with data is, you know, people like tools to be able to analyze things and they like to do it simply. And there aren't that many accessible tools for people to do that, right? Other than Excel, which we all have on our desktops. So sometimes it's just something bigger than you can handle in Excel is big data, or it could be, you know, weblogs. Weblogs are commonly associated even with the largest Hadoop deployments is what's in the big data. But, you know, we've been at this for a while and we're seeing people index really interesting things. Like, so for security purposes, right? Mobile phone providers that produce apps, they might, for example, their phones might log in and check for updates all day, right? Those updates are going to generate authentication requests. You get millions and hundreds of millions of users times authentication requests, and that data gets pretty darn big, and it gets difficult to use and deal with. So the IT, the folks that we talk to, the data just kind of grows over time, and it might not be 8,000 terabytes today, but just the fact that they have to go back, maybe Neiman Marcus has to go back through X years worth of log data or X years worth, that itself could be quite a task. And you could think of that as pretty darn big.
All right. Now, I'm going to give you the opportunity here because I know you can do it because I've seen you do it, to take this ephemeral big data buzzword cloud thingy and bring it down to earth. You've got a couple of examples of big data usage within your product. What do you want to start with?
Okay, so I'll tell you a really cool story first. Which I think most people can actually relate to. There's a customer of ours, of Splunk's, in Japan. They manage something like on the order of a few thousand office buildings. They take the machine data coming off of every time you swipe in to get into a suite. Let's say you rent an office suite. You're, you know, Twit Asia. And you every time you swipe in that suite, and every single time anyone goes up and down the elevators. So think about it, if you were the omnipresent one, what would you be watching? You'd be watching human behavior, right? Who's entering what suite at what time and who's going up and down. They actually use this as an economic indicator to see whether people are going to renew their leases.
Okay.
So it's a kind of an interesting example. If you start to personalize things and you look around you, and the number of people that actually deal with the number of folks that just deal with machines, all that data is being collected. And that's what we were kind of talking about earlier. You know, people use our product to deal with machine data, which is a really popular use of big data. So I can I have a couple of cool examples and a few things to talk about that I could show on my screen if you guys would like to.
Yeah, let's do that. But you know, actually I love that example because it actually brings to light something that I think has been holding big data back, and that is people, when they think of big data, of course they're thinking of the huge scale, multiple terabytes of data, and they don't realize that the actual monetization of that big data is going to start with the example that you just gave us, looking at data that you're getting from your premise and finding a way to make some sort of correlation and monetize from that. So go on your demo.
So commercial for Splunk, go there, download it. You can download it, and it's free to use too. So if you want to use it at home to do some interesting things, go for it. It's free for that. Enterprises also become customers of it.
Right.
So the nice thing about Splunk is it's easy to put data in, and it isn't necessarily a complete commercial for Splunk. It's just that I find it's a pretty easy tool for people to actually use to get things done. And there's an enthusiast out there who's in our customer base or in our community who's really big into baseball.
Okay. Right? All right.
This concept of sabermetrics, right? Mm-hmm. And so he wrote an app, and it's free. You go to Splunk.com, or our community is over called Splunk Base, and you can plug it into your Splunk server, and you just run a little script, and it downloads however many years of data that you'd like to download from the major MLB's website, because they make that stuff available in a nice, you know, format. And he put together a nice interface where, you know, literally you can just go in and maybe search for maybe one of your favorite players. And obviously there are a bunch of folks named Cabrera, so you might pick a particular one you're interested in, like Miguel, for example. And then you might do a search on them. And, you know, depending on maybe you're at home and you're thinking about, the sort of fantasy baseball for next year, you might want to do research on a particular player. So you might look over time, let's say look at Miguel Cabrera in 2011. And you can find some of this information on the web. But the person that wrote this app made it so that we could actually see all the things that happened with Miguel Cabrera, the last 10 games that he played, visually see whether it was a hit, you know, a strikeout, a walk. And then the actual game events, which I, you know, when I was checking out this app, I thought it was kind of cool because you could look at a summary set of statistics, but not actually know, well, how did they get there? And what did they do? So this is a Major League Baseball app is actually kind of cool. And you could even go down if you were looking at players, even like a pitcher, for example, go into see which pitchers did intentional walks over a particular time. And that's, you know, like I said, that particular use case might be a lot bigger than you could put on Excel. And if you think about it, if you download that data onto Excel, you might have a little bit of trouble.
Right.
But this is kind of a nice little app that just plugs into Splunk and you take that data and put it in and you're kind of, you can get some cool stuff done.
Right. So you were able to take a huge data dump and now just drill down into individual players. Now, Well, I know with the Splunk tool, one of the things that we can actually do is we can start to make correlations. We could start comparing players, or we could start looking at players versus, say, what their fantasy baseball cost would be. I could see someone using a Splunk tool and like the last 10 years of MLB data, which is freely available, to honestly create a sabermetric system inside their computer. And that would be it. That could run their entire fantasy draft as long as they ask for the right relations.
Yeah, and you do that for free because based on the size of that data, which isn't probably much more than a few gigabytes, and that doesn't happen very often, they could probably just use it for free at home. And that's one of the ways in which lots of folks become customers of ours. They use it either for a project at home or for something in their company, and they get stuff done, and then they decide to become a customer.
Now, Michael, I know I didn't introduce you to the chat room, but the chat room is my external brain. They're really, really bright, but they're coming up with some good questions right now. There's a few who are saying, hey, look, that's just simple SQL queries, or I could do all this on my own without the need for some database. But I think the thing that has always impressed me about Splunk is the scalability, right? I mean, we're starting small because we're looking at a smallish data set. We're looking at particular relationships, but I can grow that bigger and bigger and bigger as I add more and more data. Do you have another example that maybe gets a little bit larger than just baseball?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, also to follow up on that is, you know, part of the challenge on dealing with any sort of data is you got to, like, if you want to take and make sense out of it, you actually have to put it inside of a database, which automatically cuts out like 99% of people because they have to install and put it in a database and get things working. And then let's say they're a fantasy football person in the winter and then a fantasy baseball person in the summer. There's actually completely different plays and fields associated with that. So you'd need a lot of different, it would take a lot of work.
Right.
And I sort of like being able to throw anything in it. Now, one of the parts of our company that we have called a corporate social responsibility program, cutely named Splunk for Good. And what we try to do is do good things with our technology. We do things like volunteer at soup kitchens and other things like that. But we also try to, provide not-for-profit licenses and data projects associated with different different folks that might be interested in. All of this data you're seeing is actually in the same system, which would be really difficult to do with a traditional relational database, single instance of Splunk. But on this page, and you know, you actually can go check this out like now or later if you're listening to the podcast. Go to splunkforgood.com and click on live projects. And we did some interesting work. We were on FEMA, you know, the U.S. government's innovation team right after, before and after Hurricane Sandy. And they asked us to analyze the mental health state of people who were victims of Hurricane Sandy, which I'll tell you as a nerd is weird, right? It's totally weird to be looking in a system and see the word, to search on the word scared, because you and I and Chi deal with IT data all the time.
Right.
But to actually see emotion in there was it gave me the chills the first time I saw it. But we ingested all of the tweets that happened around right around that time range. And there was something like, you know, 7.3 million tweets. You know, I actually don't think that's a big data set. Just because I've been working for Splunk for a long time, where people actually index like tens of terabytes a day. But if you were to think about it, if you were going to do analysis in Microsoft Excel or even in a database, 7.3 million records might be a lot. But what was interesting is to seeing like the spike at which people started saying the phrase, I'm scared, over time, and breaking that down by gender.
Wow.
And also, you know, anytime you're going to go ahead and do any sort of analysis, half of the battle is getting the data in and then making a query that represents what you want, perhaps joining with data, and then putting it on a screen where somebody can look at. It's not as easy. Doing it on your own isn't easy as it looks. We try to make it easy in Splunk.
Right.
So we did a few things like, because FEMA really wanted to say, okay, next disaster, what kind of folks do we need to have on the ground to deal with how people felt about the situation that they had found themselves in, right? Over the primary storm. So I looked at who was tweeting, please help. And it's really kind of crazy to look at this over time. And this is like, you know, again, this isn't baseball hits, right? This is somebody where they're scared and they need help. And then the sentiment associated with that. So one of our data providers, DataSift, one of the major social feed providers does sentiment analysis. So I put that on there. And then we started to also look at things like, okay, what do people care about more? Power, food, or fuel? So the overall sentiment score then, well, it was a short-term disaster. I mean, it was a terrible disaster, but power was the thing that they most worried about. And then they also asked us, they said, well, I wonder if people said, I'm going to leave, when they're leaving. And, you know, you start to see people saying, I'm going to leave after Sandy actually approached. And that kind of stuff is pretty interesting. And in that same system, we say, oh, let's actually render the tweets and show the images so that we can really get an interesting view.
That's more visceral.
And that, that kind of helped FEMA get an idea literally on how people felt, what they went through, and almost what that actually looked like.
Now, you also could have, if you really wanted to, you could, say, take the geographical location of the tweets and make a correlation between the storm plot. You could show when this was happening, the storm was in this position and the winds were at this position. And you could correlate between, say, wind direction or wind intensity and the number of tweets that you're getting that are saying, I'm scared.
Yeah, and social media is going to be an indicator, of course, right? Because there's going to be a point in time where people aren't going to be tweeting. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, it's not, and even it's an indicator of other things. A couple cool other things, depending on how much time we have.
Hold on. One second, Michael, because I do want to go around the horn again. I want to start with you, Oliver, because, you know, you expressed a really good sentiment. The thing that we had heard the most, which is not big data again. Are you going to again tell me that big data is the future of transactions, even though I haven't seen anything? Seeing this, which I think this demonstration actually brings it closer to a tool that I could see myself using. If this is what we start seeing from Hadoop databases, if this is what we start seeing from relational databases, does it make sense that someone would be excited about monetizing this?
Well, let's go back to your question. A, I'm not sure how you would use this. And B, you bring up money. Anyone's going to be excited about making money on anything. So I'm not sure how that applies to Hadoop as opposed to other things.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, let me rephrase it then. If this was a presentation that someone made to you on why your company needs to use big data, why it needs a product that will actually take, let's say, customer sentiment. Let's say you're running a publishing company, and now you're using data sets from social media as well as, say, customer subscription numbers to correlate when people are interested, when people are not interested in the stories, when they are more likely to buy subscriptions and when they're not. Does that suddenly make this big data term less vaporware and more, okay, yeah, that's a good way to do business?
Yes, although if I'm a publishing company, I'm too broke to do this. But okay, if I'm in a different organization and I get a presentation like that, then Yes. However, I mean, put yourself in a publisher's chair right now based on the presentation you just made. That sounds useful, but do I know it is or don't I? It's a test, right? I'd have to go out and proof it out. It's a very difficult thing to proof out unless you have a large data set. So it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, right? I think it's like anything else. I think it's going to wind up being a use case kind of a thing. Other people's success stories will spur this on. But I think maybe part of the reason we've been seeing slow adoption is, A, it's a ton of work to actually integrate multiple data warehouses into something that looks like a big data repository, slap something like Hadoop on top of it, and make that work. So do I think it's inevitable? Yes. Do I know how soon it's inevitable? No.
Got it. Chibert, let me go over to you. I know for a fact that you've used Splunk in some non-network IT environments. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you've been doing with a relational database?
Actually, in this case, I'm actually trying to sell a project on letting me set up a Splunk system. And the problem is I've got photovoltaic data from 6 different manufacturers, all formatted differently. I've got wave data coming from 2 different facilities. I've got windmill data coming from 10 different vendors. I've got battery pack systems so you could get through brownouts and so forth. You place these giant battery systems in different places to handle sags and so forth. I'm looking at cloud data and so forth. I'm looking at a lot of different types of data coming from all kinds of different places in addition to the smart meter stuff. And the problem is every single stinking data source is formatted differently. If there was any job for big data, this is it. Because right now, each of the different facets of this energy project is collecting and their own data and formatting it how it makes sense for them. Because of this lack of coordination, there isn't a freaking chance in hell I'd be able to do any kind of cross-correlation between the different energy sources and storage sources without using something like Hadoop or Splunk.
Got it.
So I'm actually a recipient of one of those Splunk for Good grants. And just as I can finally get the engineers to take their head out of the sand and let me set up Splunk and eat the learning curve on it, I think it'd be really cool because if I can correlate, say, cloud coverage and be able to tell my electric company when each neighborhood is going to get occluded by the clouds, now all of a sudden photovoltaic energy is much more practical because the electric company knows when a neighborhood's going to stop producing.
Got it. Let me go back over to you, Michael, because we've got another good question from the chat room. We have M5 who is asking, how does Splunk format the data from different sources into the same format? He's wondering if it's magic. Maybe you could show us with the next data set that you've got going.
Yeah, perhaps. So Splunk itself is actually not a relational backend. It sort of has NoSQL sort of time series backend. And we basically index data, we figure out what its timestamp is and store everything in its raw format. And then when you look for it, we're going to infer the structure at the time at which we search, right?
Okay,
so here's an example of what Splunk sort of looks like if you've never seen it. You know, I didn't have a priori knowledge of this particular data set. In this case, this is a pile of tweets. Okay. And the big data thing does hit home because if you take and look for the phrases site is down, website sucks, or various things that people actually would bitch about on Twitter, and they do, that those are the things that get to executives that IT people only hear about after the fact. And one of the things that we're talking about lately is let's take that data, mash all of it up in Splunk, so that the marketing guy can actually see a little thermometer of when the site is having an issue. At the same time, he and the IT folks can see that, you know, let's say sentiment is down because, you know, somebody's reporting that you're failing. But as I was saying, we don't have any a priori knowledge of this particular schema. This happens to be JSON. That's wonderful. Splunk actually extracts the fields at the time at which you retrieve it. Okay, so this is sort of like the utilitarian interface where you can type anything from the you know, a star and look in a time range. And that time range could be the last 30 days. It could be real time and all of that. And I have a bunch of different data sources in here, things from Twitter coming in the syslog from my house routers. So you couldn't actually design a database schema that matched all these kind of formats. So we tried to put some intelligence around when you request it, then we'll actually infer the structure. But there's a good part of our community that uses Splunk like this. And there's also another good part of our community as a result of Splunk 6.0 that uses Splunk like this. So we have a brand new part of our product called Pivot, where you don't actually have to interact with the search language at all. You literally can pick columns, pick rows, split by different things and generate the visualizations that you want. Because what I found over the 8 years I worked at Splunk is what people do with data is they alert on it when it reaches a critical state. They make dashboards so they can look at things and alert themselves of it. And then they need the ability to kind of drill down and find things out. And, you know, hopefully that answers a question for the person in the chat room. But, you know, one of the best things I encourage is people to check it out.
Right.
So
right.
Here's, we had the folks at another cool thing. If you were a Ford car owner, some of the newer models have this data standard in it called OpenXC. And Ford let us use two cars earlier this year, the 2013 Escape and the 2014 Focus, electric powered and gas powered. And then they put this little, you know, device in it. And we had a wireless connection, Bluetooth connection to it. There was somebody sitting in the back and a copy of Splunk and they were indexing it. And it was kind of interesting to watch how people actually drove through San Francisco. You know, how fast that they drove and, you know,
I don't think
maybe
I want
you
want
to go ahead and put a speed trap in a certain area, but like 53 miles an hour through San Francisco, which is, you know, I mean, they're driving these things like go-karts.
It sounds to me as if that would be a key to any sort of tool that makes big data understandable, which is it could take these disparate data sets, not all of which are in a nice, neat format, and turn it into something intelligible.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the data format from Ford was designed by Ford.
Right.
The data format for Twitter was designed by Twitter. The data format for SSH logins was designed and hasn't been updated by the person who created SSH. Mm-hmm. Right. I swear one of these days I'm going to try to make a commit to SSH to actually have them log in a format that anybody can recognize, right? So that the engineers of the world don't have to do regex, right. But you know, and then if you want to follow the money. So this, I swear to God, this you got to check out. It's on Splunk for Good. There's this little explorer for the Federal Election Commission campaign data.
Oh, no.
So we index this, right? So we index all this data and we put together a user interface. And obviously you can see, you know, follow the money. But the key thing to do is click the explore button. And then you can go over here and let's type occupation. Talk. Show host
and find out where their money is going.
And then it's going to go and plot, it should give you a plot of different talk show hosts. Whoa. Over time in a particular cluster, what their affiliation is.
And this is publicly accessible data.
Yeah, this is actually
kind of crazy.
Federal Election Commission.
Yeah,
there,
so wow.
You can download it yourself, and we have a little tutorial on how to do that. And it's really sort of interesting when you take data, and I don't really think the bigness is that important. It's just that now everything is spitting out more and more and more and more data. Bigness is important because it requires scale. It's why Hadoop was invented, to make website, to make web logs easy to report on. But we're just getting, you know, IT folks and everybody's just getting deluged with a massive amount of data. Even, you know, I have two nests in my house.
I've just been informed that our talk show host, Leo Laporte, was actually in that list.
Really? Oh,
I did not go back there. I'll look at it after the show. Now before we have to let you go, because we actually are pushing up against the hour, there is one story that I want to talk about. I didn't want to cover it in the Enterprise Bite because I wanted your input on it. And that is that just a while ago, in fact, less than an hour ago, Google announced their intention to buy Nest, which is that thermostat / smoke detector company that makes really nice devices for the home, for $3.2 billion. And they're calling it in the quest for the conscious home. Now, this is interesting for many reasons. I mean, you could go into the whole, well, Nest was started by Apple engineers. It has Apple styling. It works with iOS devices and Google's, of course, Android. But I think the more interesting side to this is, what is Google buying? In that, in getting into Nest, in getting into a thermostat, especially getting into the thermostat, they can possibly, with a couple of tweaks, suddenly get information on millions and millions of Americans' energy usage / preferred comfort settings in their homes. If this was a big data set, if I've ever heard of it. Let me go to you first, Michael. This is a huge data set, right? I mean, and this is one of those data set that it doesn't sound like people would fight too much. Why wouldn't they let their Google app synchronize with their Nest and therefore give Google a peek into the home?
Yeah, it really depends on what you want people to do with your data. I mean, I don't know if there's a, I don't necessarily know that there's a complete assumption that you're using this connected device and that people are looking at your data. I mean, one of the things that companies like Nest and even Jawbone do is they'll use it to see how the device is performing, right? Nest also uses big data to, you know, to help optimize your energy. But it's going to be really interesting as more of this consolidation happens with machine data providers and all of this stuff that's been going on with privacy, whether the public is going to be so cool. Me, I swear I want Amex to have access to my TripIt and Facebook accounts.
Yeah, right?
Because you know why? Because I don't want my credit card cut off. And Amex didn't do this to me. Somebody else did. I don't want my credit card cut off when I'm on vacation in Orlando trying to refill my rental car. I'm already signaling on social. And I think that's the do good types of things. If I give you my data, do good stuff with it.
I love that. Okay, Michael, I want to give that over to Chibert. Chibert, and this is also from M5 in the chat room. He says, well, you know, now you can know when users are not at home. But, you know, not being funny, that could actually be a feature that Google could offer. Say, look, we're already scanning your emails. We already know when you're making your trips because that's all in, you know, our Google search queries. As long as we anonymize it and make sure that no one else has it, wouldn't you like us to be able to adjust your thermostat for you so that when you're gone, you're not burning heat up in your house? That's something that Google could offer. And then in turn say, oh, and by the way, we're going to anonymize your data because we would love to know when the high energy points are of the day. Do you see that? Is that a possible scenario?
Oh, you bet. I want Jarvis by Google.
Okay, there you go.
Right, yeah. Me too.
Control my... Okay, but okay, wait. We've got three very excited voices. Oliver?
Sure, it's exciting. But this is once again one of those examples. It's so convenient. Let's just do it. Let's just run out there and do it.
Fair game.
Don't think about it. Let's just do it now.
Fair game.
I don't know. Maybe you want to think about it. Maybe you want to, pay Brian some money and let him, you know, bang away on it for a while. Then I love it. Then I'm all over it. Because it does sound great. It's just, you know, I get a call from Jarvis.com telling me, hey, why don't you hook up your entire life? By the way, did you see that Sense robot there at CES that I read about? That's kind of this thing already. I'm waiting for that to blow up. So, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm a bit of a pessimist. So just do some due diligence, and then I'm all enthusiastic.
Don't be sorry, Oliver. That's why we love you. We need someone on the team who can say, wait a minute, why are you being stupid? Gentlemen, I'm sorry. We actually have gone over our hour. I'm going to have to call it. This is a fascinating discussion. We're going to have you back. But first, I want to thank all the panelists for making this just a lot of fun. Chibert, let's start with you. What do you need the Twilight Ride to know about? I know you've got an interesting event coming up in March. Maybe you want to mention that?
Yes, indeed. March 15th at Iolani High School here in Honolulu, we are going to run the first Honolulu Mini Maker Fair. So I'm actually trying to convince Padre and Snubs to come down and do a special. Please.
Leo, can we go to Hawaii? We need a producer too. All right, Oliver, over to you. And again, I'm sorry it's been so long between shows. I'm not going to let that happen again. I know the Twilight Riot loves you. We're going to have you back. But tell us, what are you doing other than healing from laying down your motorcycle?
Well, I'm apparently running the Mini Makers Fair in Hawaii in a couple of months, so I'm probably going to be there. Other than that, I've started a new writing project at InfoWorld. I've actually already started. I just can't talk about it yet, so, you know, be on the lookout.
I got it. Okay. We'll keep you on the feeds. And Michael Wilde, I wanted you on the show back when we were in the single digit episodes, just because I've known what Splunk can do, and you're a really, really good guy. You're eloquent. You know your product. You know your technology. Tell us, what should the Twiat Right know about? Where can they find you? Where can they find the tool? Anything. Give 60 seconds to tell us what you want to tell us.
Oh, yeah. Just go to Splunk.com. Check it out. You can find me by just Googling Splunk Ninja. It's easy to find. And then about 7.5 months ago, I started practicing yoga. And I'll tell you, I'm up to 6 days a week now. For security guys and IT people, it is awesome because our brains never stop. Like, seriously, we're solving problems the minute we go to wake up in the morning, the minute we go to bed. We're sitting, eating, we're thinking about X. Yoga has allowed me to become extremely healthy, but it's given me 1 hour a day where all the thoughts are blocked out and I can give it to myself. And I swear it is pretty awesome. There's a good chance later on this year at Splunk User Conference in Las Vegas that I'm going to be teaching yoga there. So if you're a customer, come out.
I got to show up for that.
And namaste with me.
Namaste. Namaste.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. You've reached the end of our hour of the best dang enterprise podcast, the best enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 12 out of 13 Cardinals. Now, this podcast doesn't just happen. It happens because of you, because of our listeners, because of our loyal watchers, because you guys download This Week in Enterprise Tech week after week after week. So, of course, we want to make it easy for you to do that. What I'd like you to do is to go over to our show page at twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll be able to find a drop-down menu that will give you all the options for having every episode downloaded automatically into your device of choice. Do you want the audio version for your drive home? Sure. Do you want the video version on your iPhone? Of course. Do you want the high-resolution video file for your iPad? Well, it's just a click away. And as long as you're doing that, why not subscribe to our YouTube page at youtube.com/Twiat, where we will be doing some special events in the near future. You're going to need to be subscribed if you want to participate. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at PadreSJ. That's twitter.com/PadreSJ. There you'll be able to find out what I'm doing, even when I'm not doing Twiat. You'll be able to suggest topics for future shows and even guests. It's a fun way to keep up with the Digital Jesuit. Also, did you know that we do this show live? That's right, live every week, Mondays at 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. I almost forgot that we had moved to a new time. You can find us here at live.twit.tv. And as long as you're watching us live, why not jump into our live chat room at irc.twit.tv? There you'll find some of the brightest engineers, some of the funniest trolls, and just some truly wonderful Twit Army members. Now, if I remember correctly, this show also involves a TD who does his own show that is somewhat about Android. Jason, do you know anything about that?
Insert shtick here about Android show that Jason does, and it's called All About Android, and it's still, even with all the schedule changes, still on Tuesday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific. That's right. We didn't change. We're still there. Unlike some shows the network.
Now you know it. Now you know. All About Android is the core of the show, and everything else revolves around it.
The network revolves around All About Android. Didn't you already know this?
I know. Now I remember. Thanks to everyone who made this show possible, especially Carson, my super producer, to Jason, the TD, and to all of you for stopping by. I'm Father Robert Ballas here, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiat.